Welcome to Establish the Edge. I'm your host, Mike Leone, here for part 7 of the ETE offseason projection special with Ben Gretsch, where we're going division by division, comparing our projections and giving a bunch of actionable takeaways based off of that. We have the NFC West today, which is a pretty fun division. 4 teams that I think we'll get a lot out of that all have pretty significant fantasy upside. Before we get into stuff, make sure you are following Ben at his Substack, bengretsch.substack.com, on Twitter at yardspergretsch. And you can also follow his podcast with Sean Siegel, Stealing Bananas. You can find that on iTunes. You can find all of my stuff over at Establish the Run. I just wrote an article looking at last year's extreme running back strategies in the underdog best ball tournament, hyperfragile strategies, zero RB strategy, kind of took a deep dive into what those teams looked like as far as the players that made them up, the players that were successful in those builds, and tried to draw some galaxy brain ideas from there. So check that out. But Ben, now it's time for the NFC West. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good. The NFC West is fun. We got 4 interesting offenses for sure.
We do. Right off the bat, we have Arizona, who we have like really close in terms of play calling. I have them a little pass heavier, but we both have them as one of the fastest paced teams in the league at just under 67 plays per game. I've got them more like 36.5 pass attempts per game, around 36. I've got them 28 rush attempts per game. You've got them at 20.5. So you've got Kyler with a little more rushing upside than me, but we were pretty close here. We each have him around 4,500 passing yards, right around 30 passing touchdowns. And as I said, the rushing's a little different. I've got him at 622 rush yards. You have 756. I have him at, you know, almost one less rushing touchdown. Sometimes doing these projections, the quarterback rushing stuff is difficult because guys fit into very specific buckets, and it's hard to know what regression to layer in because the league average at the quarterback position doesn't make sense for a lot of guys, right, in terms of regression for rushing. And it's even guys that don't run a lot, like Tom Brady, for example, will have really high rush TD rates because he is used in the QB sneak role quite a bit. But like, obviously his yards per carry, we don't really want affecting Kyler Murray. So sometimes I do come out a little conservative on the rushing side of things for these guys.
I'll note, I had a hard time with how far to kind of pull it down. You know, he had those comments that they want his running to be a luxury. I wasn't diving into that too much because, I mean, that makes sense. You want, obviously, him to be passing. Like, that's what the offense is built around, and then the running is kind of secondary. But I did project him for 7 fewer rushes and, like, 65, it's looking like, yards that fewer than last year, and about almost 4 touchdowns fewer rushing than last year with an extra game, right? So these projections are 17 game projections. So you've come down a little bit further than that even, but so we both, I mean, I think that's kind of the headline. It's like, we both expect him to run a little bit less this year. Where he falls is probably going to be somewhere in between there.
Yeah. And I'm probably going to up my efficiency a little bit because we're actually pretty close on rush attempts. You're right around 124 rush attempts. So it's going to be pulled back, still part of that clear, I think, like second quarterback tier. I might not have him as far up as others. Like, I think I prefer Josh Allen. I prefer Lamar Jackson to Kyler. And I think like him and Dak are pretty close. I probably prefer Dak. We'll get into that when we get to the NFC East, but I just have a obsession with the Dallas Cowboys offense. As far as how this flows through to the pass catchers, though, DeAndre Hopkins, we saw that even though this is a team that spreads out the ball, he's going to command, you know, his alpha target share. So we've got him around 160-ish targets, around 1,300 receiving yards, around 110 receptions, 8 receiving touchdowns. We're pretty similar there. We're also pretty similar in having Rondale Moore as our favorite fantasy asset of the receivers behind DeAndre Hopkins. And Ben, this is a guy where the narrative's pretty easy to make for Rondale Moore being successful in this offense because it's a low ADOT offense that throws, you know, a lot, runs a lot of plays. And Rondale Moore was a really low ADOT, really good after the catch guy in college. And I think that fits really well. I know Sean Siegel has talked about how he thinks Rondale Moore, though, you'll can sometimes get cornered into this like short area of the field role, but thinks he can be a little bit more explosive. I think he compared him to Tyreek Hill light, like to an extent. So I'm excited about Rondale Moore. He's one of the rookie receivers I think I have the most exposure to so far.
Yeah. I mean, true freshman breakout in college, you know, monster profile, didn't play a ton in his second and third year, but just like a monster production profile for a true freshman in the Big Ten. I have said earlier this offseason, I think he has the potential for 80 catches, and the way he gets there. And the reason I say that is I've been sort of obsessed with this jet motion tip pass, you know, just the jet motion in general that we've seen a ton of from, and a lot of teams are doing it. We know that motion makes teams more efficient on offense. It seems to be like the latest trend that's getting copycatted. We know that like guys like Deebo Samuel got a lot of free catches off that type of action. If Moore gets that type of role, and you would think that in a shotgun spread option, you know, offense, that they would have some elements of that, and he's a perfect fit for it. If he gets that, I mean, he might have 20, 30 free catches in PPR leagues, which are huge. And then, you know, we were just talking about how you were just saying how explosive he is. Like, this guy's a rock. He's small, but he's awesome in terms of his physical abilities. And yeah, he could be really good as a rookie.
And I did gloss over Hopkins a little bit because we're so in line with him, but where does he fit for you in terms of, you know, the wide receiver tiers and those like first five wide receivers? I think he's in that top five, maybe top six for you with your AJ Brown love, might have him ahead. How do you have that spitting out?
Hopkins came out in my projections just under a point above Brown, so he did beat out Brown,
but you tiebreaker Brown that, like,
yeah, and that's the problem for me in drafts is like I tend to lean towards the young guys, and so I want to take Brown, but I got to get some Hopkins. I mean, you look at his target share, and just his ability, like DeAndre Hopkins is really good at football. There's not a lot of guys like he gains a lot of additional efficiency with his body control on sidelines and his hands and a lot of things that he can do that. There's just a lot of receivers that don't make some of the catches that he makes. And so, yeah, I mean, he's going to be an efficient player. He's going to see a ton of targets as well. We know that. So he's an easy guy to like at the top of drafts.
Yeah. And he went through a little lull in the middle of the season, but like the bookends of the season is just so many targets. I mean, he could be racking up double digit targets every game. And he's the type of player that can have, I mean, we saw it literally his first game for Arizona. He goes out, puts up 14 for 151, and you're getting this huge ceiling, you know, without a touchdown, without a big play, really. And if they're, you know, if that stays pretty consistent throughout the course of the season, like that's the upside case for him, is like the bookends of last year just last for the entire season. Okay. Definitely. So now we'll get into a player that you'll probably yell at me because I have exposure to in best ball, which is AJ Green. I've reclaimed my title of the old lover. You know, I've tried to get at you in a few of these kind of in preparation of knowing that my old love would shine through in these last couple of podcasts. And we don't have like significantly different projections to start, but I do have AJ Green out targeting Christian Kirk. I have AJ Green about 84 targets, Kirk at 72. You have him a little bit more even, with Kirk at 77 and AJ Green at 74. This is somewhat feel-based to me, but just like some of the quotes I've seen from Cliff Kingsbury, it seems like, right or wrong, you know, AJ Green's penciled in as a starter, and I'm just not sure where that leaves Christian Kirk here. You know, as far as if there's a guy who's going to have a skill outbreak, it's obviously going to be Christian Kirk. And this is another one of those situations where I think best ball and managed are really different, where like there's no room for AJ Green on my zero RB managed teams. Like, I don't care that like he's decent and usable, but as a wide receiver 8 or 9 on a best ball team, like I've taken that stab in the last few rounds, and Kirk's just been more expensive, so I really haven't ended up with much Kirk.
Yeah. So on the Green projection, part of what I'm baking in when I give him 70 targets is the risk that, or 74 is like, I do acknowledge that he's probably going to see some targets early in the year. It's the risk that by November and December, like he was so dusty last year that he's dusty again. And they're like, look, we're not going to keep playing you that much. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's some concern there. And the bottom could fall out really in terms of playing time, especially if Moore is really, you know, coming on strong. And we just said all these positive things about him. Kirk is actually a little bit concerning. I've mentioned targets per out run a lot on the show. He was at 18.9 and 19.7% of routes on which he was targeted over his first 2 years, which are pretty solid numbers, especially for a guy who has, you know, gotten some downfield targets. And then he was at 14.4% last year. Like in year three, really fell off. You know, I was kind of hoping he might be like the Will Fuller to Hopkins once they brought Hopkins over, but instead it was just like, we're not going to throw to you anymore because we have DeAndre Hopkins. Like Kyler's like, yeah, I don't have to throw to you anymore, and I'm happy about that. So that's probably not a good sign. So yeah, I mean, I'm not like super stoked about either. It makes it easier, I think, to be stoked about Rondale and Hopkins, especially. Like Hopkins is going to – they've added some wide receiver talent, but Hopkins is going to continue to get targets. And I think Moore has a path to being a really legit breakout rookie if these guys aren't very good, basically.
I like that take a lot. Team Rondale. And, I mean, the team could really benefit from it as well. I mean, we had Dusty Larry Fitzgerald still catching passes basically all season long. They were giving him targets still. So you replace that with Rondale Moore, and, you know, the efficiency of this offense could really improve. And it seems like it's an offense that, you know, improved last year and just on the cusp of maybe being pretty good. I know Levitan likes to refer to Cliff as the fake sharp, one of the leader of the fake sharp coaching staffs. We see that with his propensity to kick field goals all the time, which is frustrating. But we'll see if the offense can take a step forward. Tight end, man, I don't think there's anything here. I guess Dan Arnold at points in time was like kind of useful last year, but you know, we've got Max Williams, Darryl Daniels for a combined 120-ish tight end premium points, which is really low for tight end premium.
And Arnold was a skill set thing. Like they got him vertical. And Max Williams and Darryl Daniels had really low ADOTs. They're not this, like Williams, I think, was athletic at one point maybe, but he's had a lot of leg injuries. Like these are not guys that are going to do what Dan Arnold did, which wasn't even that good, like to your point.
Yeah. Nothing to see there. So let's go to running back. And this is a group that early in the offseason, I was taking a lot of James Conner at a discount to Chase Edmonds. I've tried to force myself to prioritize Chase Edmonds a little bit more recently, even though like the way my brain works, I just want to take ambiguous backfield, give me the cheaper guy. But I know if you've listened to me, I've talked about this research that JJ Zacharyson's done on RB breakouts. And you know, the market's been pretty good at picking the correct order of the RBs in these situations where you have two RBs going in the mid-tier of drafts, which kind of shows that there is upside in this offense. You know, it's not like the Jets where we have one guy going in the ninth round and another guy going around 16. We've got two guys going in this round 7 to 10 area, and the RB1 in those scenarios has had a big hit rate. And what I like for Edmonds is he had a double-digit plus target share last year, even in a very specific role. If his role expands a little bit more, you've got the targets there. He's shown he can score from outside the red zone. I think he only has what's this stat, like one goal line carry the last 2 years or something. But even with that, he's scored 5 touchdowns each of the last 2 seasons. So he can score from distance, you know, maybe like a mini Austin Eckler-ish thing for me for Edmonds. The pro case on James Conner is basically that he's Kenyon Drake light, and Kenyon Drake wrongly, but still factually was going like round 2 last season in drafts. And I know Crane thinks too that there might be a little more pass catching upside for Connor that Drake didn't have.
Yeah. One thing that I think is a positive in their favor that I noticed while doing projections, and I think is pretty insane, is only 3 players on this roster had more than 5 carries last year, which like does not happen. And that includes Kyler Murray. Drake, Edmonds, Murray were the only players on the roster that had more than 5 carries. Their backup QB had 4. No one else had more than 2. They didn't give the ball to their receivers more than a couple times. They didn't give the ball. The third running back, I think, was DJ Foster, had 2 carries. That does not happen. Like, there's a lot of teams that have plenty of games where 3 running backs get more carries than that, let alone a whole season. So Kingsbury kind of showed his hand in that regard. And I think, you know, I'm interested in Eno Benjamin. I think he was a really good prospect, and he didn't really play at all in his first year. And I think he's sort of an interesting, really late option. At the same time, like, even I can say as somebody who's a fan of his that, like, probably not going to play. You know, most of the touches are going to go to Chase Edmonds and James Conner. I think you broke it down well. Like, the concern with Edmonds is the touchdowns. Drake did get a ton of goal line work last year. That could be valuable for Conner. On the flip side, we do know that Edmonds is going to catch passes. We don't necessarily know what Connor's role will be. There could be upside there too, like you said. But typically in these ambiguous backfields, I like to target the back who catches passes, obviously. That leaves a lot more ceiling and, frankly, floor in PPR. And there's been some rumblings that they might see him as, you know, a legit option on early downs, even though they brought in Connor. So if that stuff, you know, proves true, then Edmonds is, you know, probably a strong mid-round bet. But this is a range of drafts where I find myself taking receivers a lot more often, like a lot of people are doing this year. So I haven't gotten a lot of either of them.
Yeah, I've taken a decent bit of them. I'll take Edmonds in round 7. I think when we get round 7 Edmonds, I like that. When we get round 5 Edmonds, like, that's crazy. Like, there's just such a massive difference between round 5 and round 7 for me. And then similarly for Connor, like, round 10-ish, there might be some other backs you prefer, but I think he's okay there. And then you hit on Eno Benjamin too. You know, even though he didn't play at all last year, this is a guy they could easily just replace, and they chose not to. You know, he's the RB3, like you said, probably not going to play, but he's someone that I think in managed leagues worth keeping an eye on and being a little bit quick on the wire. You know,
I mean, a lot of stuff, to your point, a lot of 7th round picks don't make it back onto the roster the next year, and it's not a deep running back room. He was inactive a lot, but like, that could have had more to do with special teams, things like that. Like, they've kept him around. They might see things they like. There's stuff in his profile that's promising. He was a good receiver at Arizona State, good workhorse back, did a lot of things that project well. So, like, he's similar to Clyde Edwards-Helaire. I know that's another, we just mentioned Sean a minute ago, but that's a comp Sean Siegel's made as well, that it's in skill set and production wise in college, very similar to Clyde Edwards-Helaire, which, you know, we see in the Kansas City offense as being a stud.
So going over to Seattle, you have Ben. Usually I'm hot on plays per game. You have Seattle for more plays per game than me. So this is a new one. You have them at 65.2. I have them at 64.4. I do have their pass rate heavier than you do, and that nets us out. I like both around 35 pass attempts per game, and then I'm about a rush attempt per game lower than you, just because I have less total play volume. And Seattle is a tough one to figure in terms of the pass rate. Early last season, they seemed like they were embracing passing to win. They had some very high pass rate over expectations. It dwindled as the season went on. Pete Carroll just not built for it. So there might be some pullback there. I might be a little bit high on that. I do think we did see, like, towards the end of the season, though, when they pulled it back, they didn't really go run heavy. They just weren't pass heavy anymore. And I've got them basically the same pass rate as last year, which might be a little high, but that'll be interesting to see. Their defense was also atrocious last year. So if the defense, you know, just naturally regresses, that would be bad for the pass rate. However, you have Russ projecting more than me because you have more efficiency. And I was taking a little bit of a closer look at my stuff, and I think I need to slide some of the efficiency up. I had Russ with, like, a decent amount of throwaways, which might not have been accurate. Like, historically, his completion percentage is higher than the 65% I have. I think a little bit closer to the 68% you have. So that is something I'm tweaking to get these numbers up. It's also hard when you have two, you know, pretty big outliers in terms of efficiency at the wide receiver position in Metcalf and Lockett. So the combination of all those three things just being so good is tough. But let me back away and say we do have an offensive coordinator change here. Schottenheimer's out. Shane Waldron is in. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's part of the reason I was willing to keep their plays per game pretty close to last year. And you talked about how last year was kind of like a tale of 2 years. Early on, they were a lot more aggressive than we've ever seen. They kind of reverted back. The thought process was like they brought in a new coordinator so that Pete Carroll could have more control. And maybe that will prove true. But when I was doing the projections, I mean, I'm looking at Shane Waldron. I'm looking at his history. He's been with the Rams. He's been their passing game coordinator for 3 years. The Rams always play fast. They emphasize tempo. And that was a big thing, not just passing, but tempo was a big thing that Russ was talking about all last offseason when there was that big drum beat about Seattle throwing. And then early in the year, it was like, oh, hey, they're letting Russ cook. I kind of think the fact that they brought in this dude from the Rams and how the Rams have always played with tempo offensively is a positive sign for their play volume. And then, you know, that's how I wound up where I was, where I still leaned a little bit run, because I think there's going to be a little bit more, you know, Pete getting his, you know, his hands in things and impacting sort of the run rate. Some of the things talked about with the defense. At the same time, like, you know, we wind up very close in pass volume. And I think we're both like saying like some of the improvements last year in pass volume are probably going to be back. They're not just going to be boring.
And I was talking with Corrine about this as well. You know, Schottenheimer, we have a pretty good history of him being a bad offensive coordinator. And I think the narrative at times the offseason has been like, oh, even Pete Carroll, even Pete Carroll said Schottenheimer was like not running enough, which is kind of crazy because Schottenheimer historically runs a lot. And it just, and I think the narrative has been overblown that they're going to be like this really run heavy team. They might not be like the crazy let Russ cook team, but Schottenheimer, even though he was willing to embrace the pass more than he ever had last year, like not a very good offensive coordinator. And Waldron coming from the Rams, where, you know,
and as their pass game coordinator, I mean, he's not, they didn't bring in a guy that was a run game coordinator. They've split their coordinator roles, the Rams, in the past. And he's been the guy that's been in charge of the passing game. Like, that's interesting, right?
Yeah. And they've gotten, you know, a lot out of, I think as much as maybe they could have out of Jared Goff. So there are some opportunities for this offense, I think, just to be really good, you know, even if they don't go crazy pass heavy, just with Russ's talent and a more, you know, ingenuitive offensive coordinator, just a better offensive coordinator, period. So Russ, for me, I do have him behind like that tier of the guys that run a little bit more, with Lamar in there and Kyler and Allen. And then I think Dak and that Dallas offense are another level. But I have Russ, this changed for me over the course of the offseason, but I do have Russ like firmly ahead of Justin Herbert as the QB6. And there are some options, especially if you're at the very front of the draft where, you know, Metcalf's there at the 2-3 turn sometimes. Lockett hasn't been making it to the 4-5 turn much recently, but if he does, then you come back 6-7 turn and you can get Russ. Like, if you miss out on the other elite quarterbacks, is a way to play it.
Yeah. I agree with that. Having him sort of comfortably over Herbert, and I've kind of worked my way to that point as well, especially after I got done with my Russ projection and saw a pretty big gap, and I feel pretty comfortable with that gap. And I agree on his price. Like, he's a real, like, he ends up being the last of, you know, quarterbacks that I'm sort of willing to pay for at a high level. I mean, I'm definitely willing to get some exposure to Herbert too, but at a certain point you're dropping off and you're like, okay, well, I can just wait for Trey Lance or Justin Fields or whatever. Like, you know, you've talked a ton about it this offseason. I think you're totally right. This could be the year of the rookie quarterback, basically. And so late round quarterback matters too, but you know, the price you can get on Russ makes him really interesting in those rounds where you're still kind of getting that really elite ceiling and you're not necessarily having to pay the elite price. I mean, I like him.
At receiver, you're higher on me than Metcalf and on Lockett for different reasons. Metcalf, we have very similar targets around, you know, the low to mid 130s. You have much higher efficiency. And I've already talked about, like, it's tough to know how much to trust the algorithm in terms of the efficiency for a receiver like Metcalf, who's pretty unique, playing with a quarterback who's pretty unique and historically efficient. So I'm probably going to bump my Metcalf efficiency a little bit, maybe not quite as high as you have it, a little bit more, but very interesting your take on Lockett. Cause I honestly wimped out a little bit where, I don't know, maybe last year, all the weeks that Lockett let me down got to me, even though his target share at the end of the day, like all things equal, even though it was very up and down throughout the year, ended up right where Metcalf's was. And I think he actually scored more fantasy points than Metcalf. Granted, like a third of them all came in one Arizona game. But you have Lockett for more targets than Metcalf, 142 to 136. And I think maybe I wimped out a little bit on Lockett's targets. I need to bring those up, but I have Metcalf kind of starting to see a gap there where I think I had Metcalf at around 23% and Lockett at 20% of the targets.
Yeah. I mean, I really like DK Metcalf. You just mentioned I'm really high in his efficiency. But I think there are some reasonable questions about, you know, like he's a perfect fit for Russell Wilson, but the fact that so many of his routes were vertical or slant, like that is true. I know it's like cliche and old hat to hear, the point that that's relevant on is, can he ever expand into like a really high volume receiver? He was at targets on 19.7% of routes last year, 18.2% as a rookie. Those are really good numbers in an offense that passed more. It was great. He obviously gets vertical routes. He gets end zone targets. I want DK Metcalf for sure. And I haven't projected for more points, and I'm drafting him. But at the same time, Lockett's targets per route run were up over 21%. He did have more targets last year, right? And you mentioned like he had the one huge game. I also think he's an interesting fit in the concept of this new, like new offense. If Waldron brings over some of the Rams things that they've done, where they did a lot of rolling out with Goff, easy throws, yak, you know, ability. They did a lot with like Cooper Kupp, where they would start him on the left side of the formation, run him underneath the offensive line into like a sprint out in the right flat, and they have Jared Goff rolling out on play action, throw a quick dump off where the receiver has crossed the formation and is catching and running. All of that kind of stuff's going to go to Lockett. Like that, I mean, some of it might go to Eskridge too, but like it fits Tyler Lockett's skill set really well, the short passing and the yak and the stuff that they've built the Rams offense on. And then, yeah, just like a longer track record of Lockett being a guy who's been very productive. You know, his targets didn't really jump until the year before last. They were under 15% per route in 2017 and 2018. But we have a couple years now of him being more of a high target guy, and definitely has that connection with Russ. And so, yeah, I mean, I got down to doing this, and I was like, you know, I really like Metcalf's efficiency. I'm going to definitely project him for way more yards per target, higher touchdown rate, all these things. But Lockett seems to me like the favorite to lead the team in targets.
And this, and when we get to the Rams, like this 3-4 turn group of wide receivers, my decisions keep getting tougher as I'm like, I'm a little bit low on Lockett, you know. And then when we get to the Rams, some of your stuff makes me think like I'm a little bit low maybe on Woods, but I'm definitely a little bit low on Kupp. And this 3-4 turn, you know, now we've got the Cowboys guys, Lockett, you throw Kupp and the Rams guys in there, DJ Moore in there, McLaurin. It's a really crowded 3-4 turn. If you play in a league, this is like total like niche, probably maybe affects less than 1%. But I feel like if you could trade down, like if you do a slow draft league and you could trade down.
How about
auctions? Yeah, I guess auctions, like just stockpiling. Yeah, these 3-4 receivers where instead of paying, like as much as I love like some of the early guys, but like you could get a big discount to some of the earlier guys and just really stockpile like six amazing wide receivers at the 3-4 turn.
Yep.
So I'm high on Eskridge at wide receiver 3. He has a bit of an odd college profile. He had a really good, he played for 4 years to start. He had a really good senior season, but it was, I think, like 6 games or something. And he dominated in those games. According to playerprofiler.com, he had a 33% target share in those 6 games. They're giving him a 90th percentile college dominator rating. And then, you know, his yards per reception in college was 23.3, which is 98th percentile. And, you know, that excites me a little bit, even though there's definitely some holes in him as a prospect. And we're always wary of guys that aren't early declares in general, but that yards per reception, like maybe I'm too quickly making the leap to like, oh my God, Russ is wide receiver 3, who I've just like see running wide open a few times a year. It just jumps out to me. So I've been drafting Eskridge a lot late. Like he's been one of my favorite round 17, round 18 best ball guys. And unlike a lot of wide receivers we've talked about over the course of this series, where I'm like, I'll take them in best ball because usable weeks, but there's no upside. Like Eskridge, there might be upside just because of the uncertainty of things. So I do think he stays in my managed portfolio a little bit.
Possibly. The concern I would throw, and this isn't just another one, you know, digging into their season logs, like no one on the team had more than 50 targets other than Lockett and Metcalf last year. The year before with Metcalf as a rookie, Jacob Hollister had 59, and then no one else had more than 50. They, for the last couple of years since Metcalf arrived, they've been Metcalf and Lockett. They have, and then, you know, a variety of tight ends at times. They throw to the running backs a decent amount. Especially for a mobile quarterback, Russell still throw to the running backs a little bit. And so that's the part that's hard for me. I mean, I know they went and they drafted him in, you know, what was it, the second round, right? And you think they're probably going to find ways to use him, certainly. But I had a hard time looking at it and seeing, you know, I projected him for over 50 targets. You have him over 60. But, I do have him projected for quite a bit more than any third receiver has had in Seattle the last couple of years. Now, those trends don't always hold. But, like, you do think, like, Metcalf and Lockett are going to dominate the targets, right? Like, that's going to probably happen. So I kind of trust those trends to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think the hope for me is that we've seen at times, when I say we see that wide receiver three running wide open a few times a year, it's a different wide receiver three or wide receiver four. And the hope is that, like, maybe Eskridge can wrangle that in a way that past wide receiver threes haven't. But I also think, like, just betting on the, you know, maybe the offense is just awesome and he's good enough to be that wide receiver three and somewhat useful. But then if he's good and there's contingent value, if, like, Lockett or Metcalf go down, like, maybe that grows. Whereas, like, Freddie Swain, you know, Penny Hart, like, they're not going to see a big jump in target share, I don't think. Like, if Lockett or Metcalf goes down, Eskridge, we don't know. Probably not, but maybe. But in general, I'm not drafting as many late wide receivers in manage, but that's kind of like my mini case for Eskridge.
For sure.
Tight end, Gerald Everett is someone I want to like, and I do like in a vacuum, but damn, the market is really like on this. And I just haven't gotten a lot of exposure to Everett as much as I wanted to. I'm looking at the FFPC Football Guys Championship rankings. And Everett, I guess that we have him ranked right even with the field at like tight end 17. So maybe I shouldn't say that. It's just there's a point in the tight end premium leagues in particular where I feel like bad guys or not as good of players start to get overdrafted a little bit more, where the tight end premium's like not even affecting them a whole ton. And I think like Everett's probably in that range. It's tough because he did have some big games for the Rams. He gets away from Tyler Higbee. It is a team that has used multiple tight ends, though, in the past. I know you have Will Disley for a lot more work than I do, but I still have Kobe Parkinson as, like, the third tight end mixing in. So when you combine the two and three, like, I am expecting multiple tight ends to be worked in here, and you start to wonder, and I just start to wonder where the ceiling is for Everett in terms of the volume that he can, the number of targets he can earn, I guess, is basically my biggest concern.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right there with you. I think everything I just said about the wide receiver three fits Everett as well. He's the new guy. I think they'll use him, but I don't think they're going to not use Will Disley. They've always liked him. He's had a hard time staying healthy, but like they've always liked him. They've always used him in at least in a sporadic role. He's going to be involved. The bet on Everett, I think, is just a bet on efficiency. Like you have Russell Wilson, maybe he catches 10 touchdowns, and it wouldn't really shock me. I mean, Everett's a really good athlete as well, so I think you can make that bet in some spots, but I'm with you. Like I want to like him more than I probably do when I look at the situation. I mean, Everett makes a lot of sense, I think, in best ball stacks with Wilson because you're betting on Wilson. Basically, like part of the reason Wilson's an interesting bet at QB is like he started to look like the true MVP candidate we've never seen early last year, and then it fell off. And I think the market is a little bit overcorrected that like, oh, we learned Wilson can't be that guy. But the reality is Wilson – like, okay, maybe it was because they passed more that he was worse, but his rates and his numbers have always been a lot better than last year. His interception rate was a lot worse. I'm trying to pull it up, but a lot worse last year than it had basically ever been. And I'm not buying that was just because he was passing more. I think he just sort of had a bad season in some respects, right? And so the bet is like, okay, they kind of figured that out, and he is able to actually have a full season that's really good. And that's something the market, I think, is sort of fading because we saw it start last year and then fall off. And then the last thing in our memory is like, yeah, Wilson couldn't hack it. Well, dude, he's good. He's really good. There's a reason, you know, Kevin Colver at PFF was calling him overrated for a long time. And now he's calling him underrated, if I'm not mistaken. Like he's basically said that he was overrated for so long that people overreacted. And now he's sort of underrated because there's a reason for a while people were comparing him to Mahomes as the two most accurate passers. And now we're kind of forgetting that he has that potential. If he's that good, Everett is going to get drug along.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the most efficient passers in NFL history. Like, I do think he's a little bit underrated. We'll go to the running backs, though. I'm going to quiz you here. Chris Carson, if you had to guess his last 16 games played, what's his line in terms of rush yards, catches, and touchdowns?
Well, I did see that his yards, or excuse me, his carries per game were a lot lower last year. So I'm guessing it's going to be lower than I would guess. You got to tell me. I would guess.
So his total yards, sorry, this is total yards, not just rush yards. I was surprised by this. Silva has in his 150 nugget, but his total yards last 16 games, 1,400 total yards, 43 catches, 12 touchdowns his last 16 games.
Yeah, he's been a lot more active as a receiver, which is really interesting.
Yeah, he's flashed a bit more upside than I thought. He's someone that, for me, like going into the offseason, like really easy third-round fade. And like honestly, I barely have any of them. I'm still not like on him, but I at least had a little bit of pause reading Silva's stuff that made me think that like this isn't the worst bet in the world. If you are, I'm basically like we've hit on so many times, like you shouldn't be taking a running back in this range, but if you are, I think Carson's fine.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason it kind of makes some sense, at least to me, and I'm even more skeptical than you on all the things you just noted and probably won't take a lot of Carson for those reasons. But part of the reason I think he makes sense is the backups are really uncertain. You know, we can kind of get into this, but like Penny, we don't really know where he is health-wise. I really like him. You know that. But DJ Dallas wasn't that great last year. Alex Collins is still hanging around. I projected him. Looks like you didn't. You projected Travis Homer. One of those dudes probably gets cut. But like they trust Carson. You expect they're probably going to lean on him. They've done it for several years in a row now. Like that's their starting running back. I can certainly – like it's not as fragile as like Mike Davis, right, who is coming to a new team and wasn't really good until last year. I mean, he was good in spurts, but wasn't like good in any kind of volume until last year. And even then, he sort of fell off pretty quick when he started having to be a lead back. Carson, I think, sort of as a dead zone running back, you can make a little bit more case for like stability in his profile. But yeah, I don't know. I just struggle with veteran running backs in this range generally.
Yeah, for sure. And Penny, I was drafting a ton early off season. You know, kind of just as a bet for the reasons you said, like a bet against Carson and because the other backups are like really weak. But then, you know, he had the cleanup procedure on his knee and you're just worried he's never going to get healthy. I guess he was there today at the first day of training camp. But they're, you know, I think he's still rehabbing, but he like made an appearance and I'm trying to, you know, I'm really trying to get into the weeds and dig here. But it's tough when you read the beat writers. This is like a total aside, but sometimes we cherry pick beat writer stuff. Cause like we're trying to find out, you know, who's going to win this battle or whatever. And I was thinking about this. You kind of need to look at everything the beat writer says, because you focus in on this one battle and it's like, oh, you know, Zach Moss is going to definitely pull away from Devin Singletary and you run with that. But then you read the other beat writer stuff and it's like Jacob Hollister could make a real dent in this offense. And you're like, okay, maybe we need to start taking all this stuff with a grain of salt.
This person's very optimistic.
I mean, that's like how beat writers are. Like that's what the fans want to hear. And I'm thinking that as I'm looking at the Penny stuff, like one of the titles in this, like, response to the first day of training camp is all aboard the DJ Dallas hype train. DJ Dallas shot out of a rocket and scores a long rushing touchdown.
Dude, that dude has never shot out of anything.
So that's just funny. A little tangent aside, but I think Penny, especially in managed leagues, is like definitely still worth a shot. And you know, whatever happens on health, you can drop him right away, right? I've definitely backed off my best ball exposure a little bit though, just because I'd hate to take someone that's such a long shot bet to begin with and then like have it be 0% at the start of this. Yeah.
So one last thing on Carson, only averaged 57 rush yards per game last year and was over 80 the 2 years prior. He played 12 games, but his receiving yards per game were up. His receptions per game were up. He was doing a lot more in the passing game. Some of that he was banged up, but like that was the thing I was kind of referencing when you first mentioned the 16 game pace. Like it's interesting. You can put that a couple different ways. The way Silva frames it, you know, says total yards and highlights how much better he's been as a receiver of late, which is important. And I think, especially because Travis Homer's not very good, like there's not a lot of pass catching threats here. Penny maybe, but DJ Dallas and Alex Collins are not pass catching threats to Chris Carson's pass catching role, which is important. But I am a little concerned about Carson's rush, like how far it dropped off last year. He was still an efficient rusher, but like it was just like his attempts per game really kind of fell off.
So we go over to the Rams, and we had them each running a lot of plays, over 66 plays per game. I had them a little bit past heavier combination of, I think they'll just trust Stafford a little bit more than they trusted Jared Goff. And then you throw in the Akers injury. Yeah, I don't know if they're willing to ride Daryl Henderson as much as we know they were willing to ride Cam Akers. We saw those huge carry games. Either way, it's interesting to see what will happen here with a better quarterback in the system. I think there's a middle ground where it's very likely to be an upgrade from Goff, but at the same time, I don't know if it's like a crazy upgrade. So be interesting to see. We have him with a pretty similar line. You definitely have his completion percentage up a couple of points from where it's been the last couple of seasons, which, you know, makes sense if you think the marriage of Stafford and Sean McVay's offense is really going to fit. I had been really down on Stafford relative to market most of the offseason, but I've started to like prop him up a little bit just based on what I just said about the pass attempts. And also, this is a team that was, if you look at their pass rate over expectation last season, I believe overall it was pretty neutral, but in the red zone, it was crazy run heavy. So we didn't get a lot of passing touchdowns. Jared Goff's passing TD rate's been really low for two straight seasons. I wonder if they trust Stafford, if there's a little bit more balance in the red zone, which could lean towards more passing touchdowns for Stafford. And ultimately, you have him for more fantasy points than me because you do have him with about four more passing touchdowns.
Yeah, but I also have Henderson from our rushing TDs. I think I just have this offense being a little bit more explosive than you generally. And I do think they're going to be good. I think Stafford is going to allow McVay to do some different things. I'm buying into, like, remember, like, going into the playoffs, they weren't sure even if Goff was healthy, if they wanted to start him. Like, that was a real thing. They were looking at starting that John Wolford guy over Goff because they felt like they were so hamstrung. I don't think Stafford's like a world beater, but I do think like having a quarterback that knows which side of the sky the sun rises and sets in is something different for Sean McVay to work with. And I have Stafford as a pretty high completion percentage. Part of that is what I talked about before. They're gonna create some easy completions, I think, for him. I think this offense is designed well in that regard. And then he just has like pretty good firepower around him. I mean, I think Cooper Kupp is one of my favorite bets right now in drafts. You know, we talked about a lot of different guys. I don't know why Woods is going ahead of him, to be honest with you. Woods barely beat him in like targets and receptions and yards last year, but he played 16 games and Kupp played 15. Kupp has a targets per out run of 23% and 23.7% over the past 2 years. Woods was down last year to 20.3%. It was a four-year low. He's age 29. Kupp's age 28. They're a lot closer in age than you'd think because Kupp came in the league at 24. Woods came in at 21 with your Bills. But, like, I mean, Woods trended down a little bit on some numbers last year. He wasn't, like, bad or anything. But really the only reason I think Kupp's going later is he didn't have a lot of touchdowns last year, which is kind of crazy because the 2 years prior he had massive touchdown rates. We've definitely seen an ability to score touchdowns out of Cooper Kupp, and Woods prior was the guy that like couldn't score TDs. So I don't know. I'm kind of shocked by the fact that Kupp, who's only in, you know, his fourth, fifth year, he is a little older than you think, but especially because he's been a little bit more target dominant in games he has played, I'm a little shocked that he goes behind Woods in drafts.
Yeah. It's weird. Cause he's had such volatile seasons, and I don't know if that's messed with people. I think 2 years in a row, he's had, you know, tough latter half of the seasons. And I don't know if it totally shows in targets per out run because he's the guy that's come off the field sometimes. And Robert Woods never comes off the field. So there's something to that. But I did have Woods ranked ahead of Kupp for most of this offseason. But I do think if you're going for like the high end upside, it's Kupp. And I've moved Kupp ahead of Woods in the projections. And with how Silva has his 150, we now do have Kupp ahead of Woods in our rankings. And basically actually slid both these guys like just ahead of the Tampa Bay guys at the 3-4 turn. For a while, I was taking the Tampa Bay guys ahead, Evans and Godwin. Like that's really kind of like how that 3-4 turn comes out to me, where I was really taking Evans, Godwin after the Cowboys guys were gone. And now it's like I've moved Jamar Chase up. I've moved Lockett up. DJ Moore's there. And I've moved the Rams guys up. So it's tough. But We all, and also, like, I mean, we had a 20 target Cooper Kupp game last year. Like, he is someone that could just rack up an insane amount of targets, and it's tough. I do think Robert Woods is, like, low key just very pretty good, and I'm comfortable with both of them.
And one thing I want to say about that, I talked to you about earlier this offseason, and I heard from some people sharper than me earlier in my career. People, because we talked about that with Lockett too. The he had, I think, a 20 target game too. You mentioned that Arizona game. I think people hear that and they're like, "Well, this guy's inconsistent." But like the thing that I talked to you about was consistency is like not. It's kind of bunk. Like what matters is that this guy racked up this many targets over the course of a season. Where they happened, like that's not usually pretty predictive year over year. And it's not a bad thing that Tyler Lockett had a 20 target game and, you know, a couple other big games and was lower in some spots. He could be a lot more consistent this year, just, you know, how it is. And same with Cooper Kupp. I agree with you. He does come off the field sometimes. That's where it's a little more concerning. It happened less last year. It was more of an issue late in 2019. I'm, you know, hopeful that that won't happen very much this year, but you know, maybe that's a concern and maybe that is the real reason. For me, I'm just looking at him going, look, his TD rate was low for the first time in his career, and people are overreacting to it. This guy's actually always been really good, and he didn't play 16 games, and they're seeing that Robert Woods had a little bit of a better season because of that too. But Kupp was better on a per-game basis, basically, other than the touchdowns. And so anyway.
Was his target share better? I thought his target share
was better. His target share was worse, I think, a little bit worse. That's why I think the yards per route run stuff is kind of interesting, but – I mean, if he does continue to come off the field, then the target share will matter more.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we're mostly in line there. Like, I've definitely come around on Cooper Kupp. I did one of the best ball, big dog, and we had that decision at 3-4 turn, and my neighbor Dan, who I drafted with, was like, let's draft Kupp, and we ended up going Kupp. And, yeah, I do think ultimately that, like, league-winning type season is more likely to come from Kupp than Woods. And again, if they do throw more in the red zone, like I think Kupp's a little bit more prone to that play calling, right? Where they really were run heavy last year in the red zone. Kupp's a very big red zone threat. So,
and Kupp did have the slightly better market share. Sorry, I kind of cut you off there, but 0.2 targets more per game, 0.01 per, you know, 1 percentage point higher target share.
Got it. Behind them, I don't think I have interest. I definitely don't have interest in anyone in managed. We've got the trio of DeSean Jackson, Tutu Atwell, and Ben Gretsch's absolute favorite wide receiver.
Yeah. What are you doing projecting Van Jefferson for 50 targets? Like, are you projecting Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp to miss time? What's happening?
I'm like generally a little bit more conservative than you are
on
the targets overall. But I don't know, man. Like, I think he's going to play, like whether we think he should or not. And D-Jax hasn't made it through a full season. Tutu Atwell is like the size of an ant. Like, I don't know. It wouldn't shock me if Van Jefferson ended up third in terms of targets for wide receivers here. But I don't want him. I haven't really drafted much of any of these guys, even in best ball. Like early on, I took some shots on DeSean Jackson. He's the prototypical hashtag better in best ball play where, you know, you're hoping to hit some big plays. Tutu, I mean, he's really small. Like he's not Devonta Smith small. Isn't he like 140 something? I mean,
he's 145 or something like that,
which is just absurd.
So my thought here is Kupp and Woods are obviously the main two receivers, and they always use Josh Reynolds as sort of their deep guy, but Jared Goff had a hard time getting the ball down the field. But they, for starters, went and got Stafford, who can be a little, you know, more vertical and you know, certainly has a massive arm. Then they go get DeSean Jackson, who's, you know, arguably the best deep threat of all time. I mean, maybe, you know, there's probably some old school guys that are going to hate on me for that because there's a lot of dudes back in the day that, you know, football was played differently back then. So maybe he's not the best deep threat of all time. I think in the modern era, probably the best deep, you know, pure deep threat. Then they also draft Tutu Atwell in the second round, who is tiny, but he's fast. He was productive in college in a way Van Jefferson wasn't. I think Jackson and Atwell are going to be these like speedster, playmaker type third guys in these three wide receiver sets that are going to stress defenses. Van Jefferson doesn't really fit that. He's not that athletic. He wasn't very productive in college. And if you just look at like what has happened since they drafted him in the second round, they started early last year splitting snaps, him and Josh Reynolds, and Reynolds basically beat him out. Like, Jefferson snaps went the wrong way in his rookie year, which is never a good sign. Typically, we see rookies build their role over the season. And then they went out and got Jackson, and they went out and drafted a receiver in the second round again the following season. So I'm pretty much digging a six-foot hole for Jefferson's career personally. But the way this offense lines up for me, like, Jackson and Atwell are the ones that if you want to make some bets, like, I think Jackson, if he stays healthy with Stafford there now, like, he's going to have some big games. He's going to be interesting.
One of the more underrated wide receivers, I think, just historically, DeSean Jackson's, you know, absurd efficiency over such a long period of time. Tight end is really interesting. I kind of, well, I'll get into backup tight end section. I have a little bit more towards Higbee. I have him at 86 targets. You have him at 78. Another spot where I might back off that a little bit. I'm excited about Higbee with the absence of Gerald Everett. I mean, we saw the insane ceiling for a small stretch of games that we're probably forever going to hold on to for Tyler Higbee when Gerald Everett was out, not last year, but the season prior. So I'm excited for Higbee. And again, if we think the team's going to throw more on the red zone, Higbee's someone that would benefit a decent bit. As far as backup tight end goes, you have, I didn't have much work for Jacob Harris. You have Jacob Harris as the clear number two. He's an interesting guy to watch. I believe he's a converted wide receiver, or some spots had him listed at wide receiver. There's been some good offseason reports on him. You know, typically, like, don't get excited for backup tight ends. You know, usually we're talking about running backs in terms of guys to watch on the wire, but I think Harris does qualify as a guy to watch on the wire.
I was just randomly looking at back at some of my rookie drafts, you know, several months ago, and I was aware of him, but yeah, at the time he was still listed as a receiver, and I don't know. I took some truly questionable players ahead of him, and then in both of these drafts that I was in, you got him. I was like, so I was really interested to see that you're not projected a big. I'm higher on him for his rookie
season. Well, my thought initially was just, and I'm probably going to change this. Yeah, in a way, I kind of like token threw away like tight end 2-3, just thinking year one he's probably not going to play a big role, but there's a chance it's bigger than I'm expecting.
Yeah, and that's probably accurate. It was interesting that when I think Higbee was out or something in OTAs that Harris was running as the tight end one ahead of some vets, and they were saying like he's earned it. He looked great, but whatever. We'll see. But he has a great athletic profile for sure. The Higbee thing, it's so hard with that 5-game stretch because the rest of his career has been pretty poor. And again, we can go back to I love targets per route run. He was over 30% in 2019, which there was only three guys, I think, in the league that were. They were all tight ends. It was him, Kittle, and Mark Andrews, who were guys whose routes are kind of, you know, cut back a little bit and are huge parts of their offense. Dropped all the way to 18.3% last year. And the vast majority of those targets came in that 5-game stretch. It's tough. I look back at that, and the way that I think about it now is like that was the year the Rams were really struggling coming off the Super Bowl run the year before. Everyone was saying that the Patriots had, you know, got the blueprint on their offense. They were trying to find something to work. And the one big note on that stretch was in those 5 games, 4 of the defenses they played either at the time or I think finished. I mean, it was the end of the season. I'm pretty sure they finished as bottom 3 against tight ends or top 3 for fantasy tight end production. Teams that couldn't defend the tight end. 4 of the teams, because they played the Cardinals twice, who were, if I'm not mistaken, the absolute worst team against tight ends. And they also played Seattle and Dallas. And so it's like they found something that worked, and also it jived with the way their schedule lined up, where like when they're game planning, they're going, this team can't guard our tight ends. And so they just had this stretch where they just really hammered it. It's interesting to think about like what we would think if it wasn't a stretch of you know, great matchups back-to-back or consecutive, if it wasn't sequencing, if it was 5 different games throughout the season, how we would think about it.
Sequencing, I guess, matters a little bit because Everett was out for the stretch.
Yeah. And that's true. But I wonder if the schedule sequencing is playing with our mind a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. That's the point that I'm – because, like, it's crazy. They lined up 4 of those 5 opponents that were, like, bottom 3, right, because they played 1 twice. It was a really, really, incredibly soft stretch for tight end defenses. I mean, I'm still kind of leaving the candle on for him. We don't see a lot of tight ends that have the type of potential that he put up in those 5 games. But last year, did happen, and he fell a lot, you know, quite a ways off. And I know Everett was still there, and now Everett's gone again. But I'm a little bit skeptical, that those five games will go down as anything other than like a huge anomaly, which is probably already, you know, doesn't need to be said really, but.
We in the fantasy community do love something tangible to hang our hats on to. So we've got that five game stretch. One concept in fantasy baseball that I think it was Bill James had, but it was kind of, you know, once you display a skill, you own it, like it's there somewhere. So there's part of me, if I'm channeling tight end upside, that high at targets per out run, even over a small sample, it's like, is that skill in there somewhere? You know, I kind of hope so. But I have him TE10, you know, which is pretty in line with the market. I do think he's before a cutoff of guys that him and Evan Ingram, like before I think guys start to just go too early, where there's like a bigger gap there than the market has it. The market has more of like a straight, like a slow decline at the tight end position. And I think like there's steeper tiers and then it flattens out with some of the later guys.
Agree. Regardless, with that. Yeah.
We can go to running back. Darrell Henderson, you know, is the primary running back here with the injury to Cam Akers out for the season. And as of now, they have not signed anybody yet. It's Xavier Jones and Jake Funk, I believe, behind Darrell Henderson.
Are you projecting a generic running back?
Yeah, they had at the one point, at an earlier point in time, they had Raymond Calais there, and I kind of just need to get Funk. I think I have Funk too, that I might not have updated our projections in the back end after I like threw in Jake Funk and Xavier Jones. I might not have just thrown.
Well, I'm just looking at your total points. Like I have Henderson quite a bit above you, which is interesting.
I do have an unlisted running back here of now to be a little bit safe.
I think that makes sense. And I considered doing that too. I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
I probably they're almost certainly going to bring someone in. The question is like, is that person going to be good? I think one of the really interesting things with Henderson is like a lot of times I think the market, especially since we've started the sort of the best ball era, the market is still anchored to the prior ADP and where they were getting this guy and all that stuff. And the guy doesn't rise enough. And I think that's happened with Henderson a little. It happened, I think, with Kareem Hunt really late that year that Spencer Ware got hurt. I think Hunt sold in like the third round or something and ended up being a monster. I think he led the league in rushing. And I go even all the way back to Arian Foster as a guy who was a huge, in his second season, was a huge preseason riser. He was like the first time I ever thought of this sort of trend that like a lot of times the preseason risers, we don't rise enough and they wind up smashing. And I haven't really done like a full analysis of it or anything. It's just sort of conjecture. But I wonder if there's a lot in Henderson's favor. There's nothing behind him right now. Whoever they're going to bring in is probably not going to be that great. Sean McVay definitely has a history of leaning on guys. He did it with Akers last year. He obviously did it with Gurley. This team you mentioned earlier has a history of running back touchdowns, big numbers running. They like to use the running backs in the red zone and close to the end zone. Henderson has a pretty good profile, explosive, never really was a massive workhorse, but it's a really good offense to be the lead rusher in. And they showed last year, they didn't give him all the passing work. They were still using Malcolm Brown a lot. It definitely didn't make him a workhorse the way they did Akers later in the year, but they showed last year a willingness to give him early down carries and lean on him for a period when Akers was hurt early in the year. He had a really good game against Buffalo, right? In Buffalo.
Yeah, he crushed Buffalo. And I think you're dead on in terms of it hasn't risen enough. Honestly, when Crane and I were recording a podcast live when the Cam Akers news broke, and we were thinking like round three to four, and he's more settled in five, six. And in best ball mania, I definitely get not drafting him here. I've advised not drafting him here just because of the unique nature of that tournament where we've already got so many teams that have a double digit round Darrell Henderson. You know, I think if he drops to like 7-8, that gap doesn't matter as much. When he's there at 5-6, like it's a little bit tougher to justify, but that's a very unique tournament and specific scenario. If you're drafting a team, basically any format, you know, I think Darrell Henderson fits in great at the 4-5 turn. You know, if I was drafting an underdog best ball where I didn't care about, that was like a brand new tournament starting today, yeah, I'd definitely be looking at him at that 4-5 turn where I've taken Miles Sanders in some builds. And it does seem to me that we're discounting the odds that Daryl Henderson is basically what we thought Cam Akers would be.
Right. Yeah. Like, and look, he hasn't done a lot as a receiver. I get that's a huge part of it, but he's been efficient as a receiver, and he was very efficient as a runner last year. And he's had a hard time staying healthy. I know that's another part of it. He's not fully healthy right now, I think, right? He's still kind of struggling with some stuff, but it is like they are thin behind him, and they're going to bring someone in at the last minute, and maybe that guy plays a ton. But I don't know. I think that's being overvalued, that like how much that person's going to cut into Henderson. Like, circumstance matters, and the circumstance is like that they might need to lean on him quite a bit. And they took him in the third round a couple years ago for a reason. He looked good last year. They also already had taken Akers, and so they ended up committing to Akers. But now Akers is out of the question, and they saw good things from Henderson last year. I mean, it lines up like it could be a smash, honestly.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm pretty pro Henderson. Anywhere in the fourth, but especially in the fifth, especially, you know, there's wide receivers start to fall off after a certain point, and Henderson looks really juicy there. Any notes on Xavier Jones, Jake Funk? I think we both think they're probably going to sign someone, although so far they said they haven't, they're not going to add a veteran.
Literally no notes on these guys.
Me neither.
I have not done much research on either of them. I should.
Yeah. Okay. We get to my Niners for the last stretch of things. We both have them around 65 plays per game, pretty similar pass run ratio, 33 pass attempts per game, 29.5 rush attempts per game. I'm projecting Lance as pretty much the starter. I don't necessarily think he's going to start that early, but as far as like his usefulness in fantasy, any spot you're taking him, I think, treating him that way in terms of his upside and fantasy impact over the course of the season makes sense. You obviously have to build smartly around him. If you're playing in best ball, you need to make sure the early games are covered. They have said, I believe right now, that, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo is the one and Trey Lance is the two. We'll see, but Lance's upside to me is just absolutely enormous between the elite rushing ability. And also, he could step in and just be, you know, a decent passer. And this team with better health, they've had horrible health the last few seasons. They could be one of the leading teams in terms of points scored in the entire NFL. You know, this offense that Shanahan has seen absurd efficiency really in both rushing and passing. You know, some of the highest yards per attempt quarterbacks the last few seasons are Jimmy Garoppolo and Nick Mullins, who objectively, you know, we don't think have played that well, and they're still up there. Some of that's due to things that the offense does for them, but that's kind of the point, you know, that Lance can walk in and be somewhat efficient. And then if he's better than those guys down the field, you know, we really could see an explosion here. You did make a note to me, and this is less to do with Lance and more just overall, when we were talking about the Niners, I forgot if it was a ship chasing episode or what, where the ADPs do seem to be baking in a lot of the upside here. So it's a tough spot for me where I really love this offense. I love the upside of it, but it's definitely priced in to a certain extent.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I love Lance. I think he's a really sharp pick. We were just saying a little bit ago, like this really could be the year of the rookie QB. I think, you know, with the elite dual threat ability at the top of drafts, there's a reason to be willing to take quarterback somewhat early, but once you get later, these guys are like the next best bets to have that type of ceiling. Lance and Fields, and Lance is probably the best bet for that for a lot of the reasons you just said about his situation and his offense. And it's, you know, not that upside's not really priced in, especially like in redraft leagues and deeper leagues where you can maybe stash him and
actually casual leagues
for sure. You carry a second quarterback. I mean, I'm fine with that. You know, if I'm advising someone who's playing sort of a casual league, like the guy's going to have monster upside when he takes over, cause he's going to run and that's going to give him a floor. Like, it's just such an easy, cheap way to get QB points. But yeah, we were talking before the show, like I'm really concentrated with my targets. I kind of see the offenses like Ayuk, Samuel, Kittle are three really good players, and there's not a lot of other dudes that are going to mix in. Like Richie James is the guy that we have as the wide receiver three. he was actually pretty good last year, but I got all excited about him, picked him up in some dynasty leagues when he had like that one start, and then he like didn't play anymore. I think they had some COVID stuff or whatever, and James was like the number one receiver for one game and was good, and I was stoked. I was like, this guy's actually got an interesting profile. And then, you know, he never really got any more snaps. Debo Samuel, a Kareem stat, over 2 yards per route run first 2 years. The stat that he pulled was the cohort in the last like 10 years. And it's just like basically all future Hall of Famers. It's like it starts with like Julio and AJ Green from that class. And, you know, AJ Brown was the most recent one. And there's a lot of other really good players.
Odell is in there.
Yeah.
It's just an absurd.
An absurd list. Debo's one of the, like, probably the least known name on the list. But, like, that guy's good at football. He's particularly good after the catch. He gets a lot of, you know, the tip passes and things we're talking about. But he's still very efficient. He still winds up with a really high yards per target, even though some of his ADOTs, like, he had games last year where he literally had, like, negative 50 air yards because it was all just tip passes. But he was still gaining 50-plus receiving yards. He's just doing so much after the catch. Ayuk, obviously, like, year two breakout, amazing candidate for that. Gets more vertical passes, gets the better types of targets. Rich Rebar just wrote a great article about that, or mentioned that in a great article where he looked at the whole league in that regard. And then obviously we know Kittle's phenomenal. And it is tough, like, how are all three of those guys going to fit together, especially if they go really run heavy with Lance. But I don't know. Like, it is one of those situations where if any of these guys goes down, I kind of just think the other two eat a ton. And there's like a really good floor. They're all good players. And then there's also a really good ceiling as well with the whole offense. Or if, you know, if Debo misses time, Ayuk and Kittle could smash, or, you know, vice versa.
Yeah. And Ayuk is definitely the guy that's more likely than Debo, I think, to have the big breakout, especially with his ability to get open and make big plays down the field. I have a tough time with him. There's sort of this dead zone. Not the running back dead zone, but a dead zone in general in drafts after you get past like T. Higgins, Adam Thielen-ish, if you want to include him in there or not, depending on if you like olds or not. After that, the wide receivers in that fifth round start to get pushed up and Ayuk starts going there. And it's tough for me. I try to channel the mindset that you've portrayed a bunch, which is, you know, small miss, big hit. And I definitely see that sort of mindset with Ayuk, where he's probably overdrafted relative to pure projection. But the larger, broader profile is that, assuming he stays healthy, like, he's not going to burn you. And there's a chance he just breaks out this year, you know? And so I get that. It is tough for me, though, that, like, when I run the math, Debo Samuel's combination of catch rate and yards per catch is so good. Because I think a lot of people say, well, he catches, you know, those BS touch passes, right? You know, that don't really count. And that's inflating his catch rate. Well, maybe that's true, but his yards per catch should not be as high as it is if that was the case. Like, that would be low. And he's pretty good in both components of things. So I have these guys really even. And I also think with those types of catches and stuff that Debo Samuel gets used on, I have a tough time seeing Ayuk out targeting Debo Samuel. And that's where I get hung up a little bit on Ayuk, where I really like him overall, but he's just going a little too early for me. So I definitely have more Debo in my profile.
Debo's such an easy pick. Ayuk at 5. Yeah. Debo, and I agree with that. Ayuk's tough. Like, he's going right by like T. Higgins and dudes that I'm really confident in, and confident in the offense. And I'm also very confident in Ayuk, but I'm just a little bit more confident in T. Higgins, I would say. Like, I feel better about T. Higgins. Debo's an easy pick. Like, he's just a really easy pick in that range. He's right near the end of where I would say, like, it starts to fall off at receiver. And, you know, when people say, like, wide receiver's not really that deep, that's what they're talking about. It's like right after Debo, right after Visca in that range. Like, I always want to take my last receiver there. Tyler Boyd goes right in that range. And I'm grabbing those guys like, yes, I can get one more good receiver before this falls off. And we're probably pushing some dudes up a little bit behind it. And, you know, you only got to go a few receivers down and you're in, like, Brandon Cooks territory. Like, yeah, Brandon Cooks could be good on volume alone, but he's not going to be a league winner in that offense, I don't think. So anyway, Debo to me is, I agree with you. It's so much easier to pull a trigger on him. He's going too low.
And if you do have the offense a little bit more concentrated like Ben does, Like, you got Ayuk for 15 more targets than me. If I had Ayuk at 121 targets, it'd be like, all right, we're smashing that in round five. It's still after T, but we'd feel better about it than kind of how I have it now. Like, I've got some Jalen Hurd stuff mixed in, and it's tough because they haven't been healthy. So we're not sure how condensed they really might get if they're healthy. They've moved in a lot of bodies in and out the last couple of seasons. But in general, high on this offense. I think there's a chance you could draft Ayuk a little bit higher than our rankings suggest. As we go to tight end, Kittle, I have a ton of exposure to early in Best Ball Manias. I've talked with Pat Crane on Ship Chasing and you a little bit last week, Ben, about like the value of the elite tight end in a like more standard league, you know, not a best ball league, maybe not necessarily a tournament. And in my head, I've naturally been like, okay, well, I'm going to shift to the wide receiver. I'm probably not taking Kittle until more like after that tier of receivers that's like Justin Jefferson, AJ Brown, Keenan Allen, you know, kind of that stretch of the 2-3 yeah. turn, DK Metcalf. You know, in best ball, sometimes I jump Kittle ahead of those guys because structurally I love the advantage. In casual leagues, I've jumped him behind, but sometimes you don't get him. So, and I'm kind of unsure about that approach and exactly how to handle that. In general, though, I think we're both pretty high on Kittle. Have him, you're kind of neck and neck with Waller. You know, Waller is a much safer bet on volume. Kittle's the guy that could just, you know, wreck things if the offense really hits and the volume is very condensed.
Yeah. Completely agree with you on the elite tight ends. The way that I'm sort of reading that is like these three guys, what we have from them is, you know, demonstrated ability to dominate targets, especially, you know, per route for in Kittle's case, because he doesn't necessarily run a ton of routes. He's such a good blocker. They hold him in a lot. Also demonstrated efficiency. Like, we know what we're getting from them. It's basically like if they stay healthy, they're going to provide you a positional advantage. Whereas I like to compare them to the elite running backs. We're kind of making the same bet. We're not, there's a high bust rate. We're not real sure. And tight ends can get hurt at a high rate. We're not real sure on the top running backs. The issue with running backs is they don't just have to stay healthy. They have to stay healthy and be good. And their offense has to be good. And all these other things have to go right. Or sometimes they're just like not that great of a pick anyway. With these tight ends, like, we know that they're going to have a gap over basically all the other tight ends, plus or minus a TJ Hawkinson or Kyle Pitts breakout or somebody, you know, coming up to them. But these guys are so much more projectable. You know, you look at last year, Kelce, Waller both had 105 and 107 catches. I think no one else at the tight end position had more than 72. And you go back to, you know, the year before when Kittle was healthy, he was, I don't know if he was over 100 catches, but he was, you know, racked up a ton of yards. I think he broke the tight end receiving yardage record or whatever. And maybe Kittle broke that. Kelce broke that last year. I don't know. But Kittle had a monster year as well. He obviously has that ceiling. I'm fine with him as tight end three. The way I look at this is like these guys are all so valuable. I think arguably, especially in tight end premium, they should all be first-round picks. And even in non-tight end premium and just straight PPR, that they should all go in probably the top 18 picks. Like, they're just super, super valuable pieces when they stay healthy. They provide such an advantage over the field. So that's been my interpretation of it. But I agree with you on all the points, and it is open to their interpretation, certainly.
Yeah, and I really – still not sure what to do. If I'm on the clock in a casual league at like 210, am I taking Kittle or am I taking DK Metcalf? Right now, I think it's Metcalf, but
I think in casual, I'm even more likely to take Kittle and get that position.
Yeah, I guess the idea in casual would be you're better than the rest of your league mates. And this is an edge that can't be like manufactured in any way.
I can get Debo at a discount because no one's going to reach up for him. Or, you know, Visca is a guy I mentioned that he's going higher in some sharp leagues. I'm going to get Visca at a discount. I'm going to build a good wide receiver core anyway. This is an edge I can't manufacture, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm starting to come around to that a little bit more and might start to boost the elite tight ends and your kind of our straight traditional ranks, not just in our best ball rankings. Because right now I do have them a little bit more valuable in best ball than I do in other formats. Going to running back, again, that study J.J. Zacharyson had is kind of the Niners to a T, where it's an ambiguous backfield, but it's a backfield that we expect to score a lot of points. And those are the backfields that you really want to attack. I don't, you know, Trey Sermon's technically the RB1 by ADP right now, but it's really close with Raheem Mostert. You and I actually both have Mostert with a little bit more work than Trey Sermon. You have the gap even wider than I do. I kind of like lean Mostert over Sermon, even though I like to go to the rookie quite often. That is counteracted by where the ADP is, where when I can get Sermon at a decent price, even if Mostert's on the clock, I've been taking Sermon just because otherwise I won't get any Sermon and I'll have all Mostert, but I definitely have more Mostert than Sermon. Mostert is a guy I took in round 8 in the FFPC Pros versus Joes. Absolutely love either of these guys in round 8. Kind of no matter what build you're doing, they fit. Full zero RB, or if you've even taken an RB early, you know, they can be your RB2 and kind of fit in a hyper fragile type thing. But as far as pure managed leagues, I think these are really good options as your first running back in a zero RB build.
Yep, I think it makes sense. I tend to lean Mostert more because he's been really efficient as a receiver. Sermon did some stuff as a receiver in college, and sometimes, you know, we see that that doesn't necessarily translate in the NFC North one. I was talking about AJ Dillon, why we shouldn't write off his receiving, and that could be the case with Trey Sermon. But I think we know that they like to use Mostert out of the backfield. He's had some really explosive plays out of the backfield. He hasn't had a ton of catches, but they did have, like, you know, Jerick McKinnon and some other dudes. So I have him, you know, definitely being more involved in the passing game. And it is interesting with these comments that, like, Sermon is going to – I know this is one Silva's mentioned before, that he's going to, like, tenderize the defense, and then Mostert's going to come. I mean, we're treating it like a fine steak, right? Like, out of the tenderize quote is so funny. But, like, if they're doing it that way, and I kind of buy that, I also think that Mostert probably isn't going to just not play in the first half. He probably comes in on third downs and passing downs in the early part of the game, and then is their explosive second half player. Like, it kind of makes sense. They would use Sermon as the early down guy and then play Mostert as the receiver, and then let him get some carries later as well, as kind of this guy that, now that when everything's nice and tenderized, he can break some big plays. And if that's the setup, then I want Mostert. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And for a while I had compared this to, you know, arbitrage on the Ravens running backs. You know, I think Mostert and Sermon are going to score as many fantasy points as Gus Edwards and J.K. Dobbins. Now the ADPs have started to shift. You know, for a while there, Gus Edwards was going about where Mostert was going while Dobbins was going in round 3 versus Sermon's, you know, round 7. And the collective cost of Mostert and Sermon was just way cheaper. Now Gus Edwards is starting to go more like round 10, 11. Even I've seen Dobbins start to slip a little bit more to like end of 3. And it's sort of the similar situation, except we have more upside just because clearly the guy you want to bet on is Baltimore, but that's fully priced in with Dobbins going around 3. We don't know who the clear guy to bet on is for San Francisco. So there's room for growth potential for both of these guys.
And then with Wilson being hurt, Jeff Wilson, Wayne Gallman makes some sense late. Like, for all the reasons you said, we know it's going to be a productive backfield. And we have seen with the Niners definitely that throughout a season, their third running back is going to probably play some snaps and do some things. Maybe Gallman, it, you know, get some TDs early. He was really good at converting near the end zone last year for the Giants, and that was a big thing that Jeff Wilson was coming in doing as a third running back alongside Mostert and like Tevin Coleman early last year. And, you know, maybe that's what we see from Gallman. He's sniping a lot of the touchdowns. I mean, I think he makes a lot of sense. You know, we really quickly kind of were joking about the Rams backup running backs. I kind of want to say the same thing though. It's another offense, like, they're worth darts because it's a valuable offense for running back production. I don't want to like leave this pod without saying, like, yeah, you probably can take some shots on those guys right now.
It's a completely reasonable Gallman take, but you can't get me to quit Elijah Mitchell until he gets cut. I'm just gonna
I got him, and he's probably one of the guys that I took over Jacob Harris. I got him in some of our dynasty leagues
too. Sure. He is sixth round draft pick, but he's really interesting. You know, he caught the ball like a little bit in college, but he's really fast. You know, it kind of seems like he fits the mold of the home run hitters in this offense. So I probably have maybe too much work split between Gallman and Mitchell right now, where Gallman as the bet is a lot more likely to be the third RB on this roster with Jeff Wilson hurt come day one. So if you're of that line of thinking, yeah, we probably have Gallman a little too buried in our ETR ranks just because I have Mitchell taking some of that work until That might be more wishful thinking, though, on my part with the athletic profile of Mitchell, who does not have too much draft capital invested in him. Would love to see him make the team, though.
Definitely.
All right. We'll be back with the NFC East. I get to talk about the Cowboys last, one of my favorite teams as far as upside. Not that that's a Super Bowl call given their ADPs, but excited for that. We should have that posted in the next day or two. And you know that will bring the ET projection special to close when we do that. So it's been a fun ride. I've had a really good time talking with Ben. Looking forward to doing it one more episode. Again, make sure to check out Ben's Substack at bengretsch.substack.com. Check out his Stealing Bananas podcast with Sean Siegel on iTunes. You can also check out the Establish the Edge podcast that you're listening to right now on iTunes. Please rate and review us. It really helps us a lot if you can do that to continue to keep providing this free content. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. We will catch you soon.